From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're spending the week listening to some of the best conversations so far this year. Back in February, we learned about a first-of-its-kind training program at a Sacramento County prison that is helping women learn how to brew coffee and, in turn, change lives for the better. Redemption Coffee at Rio Casumnas Correctional Center, RCCC, is a unique program for women with the goal to help reduce the odds of reoffending by preparing them to thrive in the coffee industry. I sat down with Jamie Mason, Redemption Coffee's program director, and Legend Hightower, an alumna of the program who now works as a coffee roaster. Well, Jamie and Legend, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Jamie, I want to start with you because this really began with you. If you can start off by sharing your background in the coffee industry and how this led to you leading Redemption Coffee at Rio Casumnas Correctional Center.
Well, I started in coffee in 1995 and kind of just fell in love with it right away and worked for different companies throughout my career as a barista. And being a barista, that's hard on your body sometimes. So I decided to start taking classes wherever I could, going to what we call in the industry cuppings and learning how to taste coffee and recognize different tasting notes, I guess. And I had great mentors that kind of guided me through the coffee industry and kind of what to do next. And I started with Bewley's a couple years before the pandemic. I was traveling around, and then obviously after the pandemic hit and we went on lockdown, we were no longer allowed to travel. And I was laid off. But before that, we had met with the sheriff's department, and they had talked about this program that I'm running right now, Redemption Coffee, and I was excited, so I just wanted to make sure that that was still going to be happening. So I called the lieutenant at the time and told him, I'll work for free, let's just get this going, don't worry, like I wasn't doing much of anything else. So I just kind of stumbled into the job. I think I denied it twice because I was afraid of failing these women. That's, I think, the biggest thing that I was afraid of. And finally, the lieutenant just wouldn't take no for an answer. And I'm certainly glad he did that.
Yeah, as I'm sure many of your students are as well. I mean, we're talking about Redemption Coffee, but also this is rebuilding a life after incarceration. Did you have a personal connection to understanding these challenges, or what gravitated you towards wanting to pursue this?
Well, I think I was incredibly ignorant to a lot of what these women have gone through in the beginning. And I had a sister who had dealt with addiction. So I think that when I finally accepted it, I was doing it for her. And then I kind of fell in love with these women I get to meet and help mentor, because there are rough waters out there and we all need a life raft sometimes. And I've had many life rafts and mentors, and I like being a life raft for another woman.
Given that there are a variety of vocational programs offered at Rio Casumnas, I mean, you have more, I think, expected or traditional ones like culinary arts and landscaping, yeah, welding, mechanics, but there are these unique programs as well. I mean, I was learning about beekeeping.
Oh,
there's,
yeah,
a wild horse program, and now there's a barista program. How do you describe Redemption Coffee to people?
I say we're changing lives through coffee. pretty simple, like, just like that. I think we've got some excellent vocational programs out there and excellent educators that really just strive to help the people being housed at Rio Casumnas right now.
I was looking at photos of the cafe, and it really just looks like any trendy cafe that you can find in a city across the country. I mean, who are the customers?
The customers are the sheriffs that work there, the employees and all the staff. We have counselors out there, other educators, the lawyers come out there too that are visiting. But that's really our customer base. And it was important to me when we were designing the cafe to make it feel like a third wave cafe. It, you know, this is a sanctuary for not only these women, but for me and the other trainer, Allison Bizarik, and the staff out there. It's just a little piece of, you know, not jail.
Yeah. Given that this is a newer vocational program at Rio Cosumnes, was this emulated off similar programs at other correctional facilities?
It wasn't. But then I had discovered another one. I go down rabbit holes. So I discovered another program in London, and they were Redemption Roasters, where they started in a facility and then they grew outside the facility and they help a number of people. That's my goal.
Walk us through the training that students go through.
We go through, it's like a three-part process, and it's just the barista skills. But when I get a new student, you know, we just go through a coffee history lesson, kind of like a coffee 101, like, and then different, like, kind of bean to cup, and then different, we go back to certain things like, say, coffee processing. Each level has a, we dive just a little bit deeper. And then in the stage two, we kind of, we start with latte art, but that also.
Like the little hearts.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And the shapes top of a latte.
Tulips or rosettas. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. But then I get excited about the science behind it. Legends over there. Just like I love milk science and, you know, anything coffee science related. So we're going into the, you know, well, why is how is it that we can do this design? You know, let's get, you know, to the nitty gritty. So they not only know how to pour these, but they understand why.
Mm. That's wonderful. And Lynch, and that brings me to you. You're an alumna of Redemption Coffee. How did you come to learn of the barista program?
Well, going through the situation that I was going through, knowing that I had a significant amount of time that I was going to be at RCCC, I started looking into the different programs that they had available, because with the criminal background that I eventually ended up having, I couldn't go back into the work that I used to do. So I was looking for new skills. Initially, I looked into the welding and the construction. However, those are more geared towards the men. Officer Takeda, he came to me and he asked me how I felt about Redemption Coffee. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm trying to do whatever it takes to get me back to my children as fast as possible. So I did that. And I also did the beekeeping program as well as the custodial. So I did all of them. But most of my time I spent with Jamie and Allison. And what got me fully interested in it was learning the history behind where coffee originated. Finding out that it originated in Ethiopia, like, struck a chord with me. And then along those lines, I started asking, well, I know I don't want to be a barista. I have fun doing it, but I don't want to be a barista for something to do as a living wage. That's not what I wanted to do. So she mentioned the company Bewley's and that they have roasters and they roast coffee. And that's where my interest went into the science behind the roasting and how do they know how long to roast it to make it taste like this. And when I started with Jamie, coffee tastes like coffee. It smelled like coffee. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I now can pick out flavor notes. I can tell you if it's been burnt or if it's been open, if it's fermented, you know, based off of the different flavors and smells and things like that it gives off. She is a wonderful mentor. She is, for whatever is going to help us be successful, she does her absolute best to make sure leaving and even after, she tries to keep up with you and make sure that everything is going okay. And she's awesome. If it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't have been at Bewley's. If I didn't know anything about Redemption Coffee, I don't think I would have had such a peaceful time at RCCC, because it gave me somewhere to put my energy, somewhere to focus on, something to, I don't want to risk losing being able to get out of the dorm to go do this, to go see, because the area is very beautiful. It's, you see green grass. You're not seeing cages and, you know, things like that. It is more so like you are away from RCCC when you're at Redemption Coffee.
Yeah, and hearing from you, I mean, prior to Redemption Coffee, I mean, it was kind of difficult figuring out the next steps in your life, you know, once you were going to be released from RCCC Rio Cosumnes, but you found Redemption Coffee, and that gave you a pathway, and it gave you really a time to also during your training to pause and to just kind of pause with yourself, which is so difficult to do for any of us. When you look back on your time there, like during that training, are there particularly special moments that you hold on to?
Well, every day is a special day when you work with Jamie, because there's no telling what, you know, our conversations we could have with her in complete and utter confidence, as long as we weren't saying we were going to harm ourselves or anything like that. So we were able to talk about us, what's going on, without fear of it being used against us. So that was always really, really good. And the fact that, you know, regardless of how tired she was, her and Allison, they always did their best to make sure that we were treated as employees and not inmates. You know, that was one of the main reasons why I stayed in the Redemption Coffee program so long, was her words to us was, you guys are employees when you're here. You're not inmates, you're not prisoners, and the officers are going to treat you as such, you know. So that was one of the main things.
I would imagine you also learned skills that can be applied outside of the coffee industry.
Well, yeah, I'm career customer service, so people skills and learning how to manage things are something that I do, and I'm a single mother of five. So I multitask very well, but there are a lot of things like I learned how to fix espresso machines and work on, we've learned how to think outside the box to come up with different stuff. It's amazing the different stuff that you'll learn as a barista, but it doesn't stop there. Jamie's program goes all the way up. It teaches you how to order supplies, how to manage a small coffee shop or even a bigger coffee shop. It goes all the way up there. It doesn't just stop at the barista level.
Yeah, so you're going from the science of it to the economics of it to the logistics of it to even the creativity of it,
yeah,
as well, and seeing what fits you the best and if you want to apply that to your life once that you were released. And you did. I mean, you landed a role at Bewley's North America, mm-hmm, in their roastery. What does that mean to you? What do you do there?
So I do a little bit of everything. I'm still learning. I have been released from RCCC since the 17th of November, so it's going on almost 3 months. And Bewley's hired me, knowing my background, knowing all of that. I'm technically a pack operator / roaster. And I'm just learning more about the Bewley's company and how we run everything so that I can make this a longevity, because they gave me a shot when I know other people would not have.
And this is a key component. It's not just training students with skills so that once they're released, it's like, okay, well, you're on your own. Go look for a job in the coffee industry. This program, this vocational program, is also connecting students with potential employers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, and I'm not the only one that Jamie and Redemption Coffee has been able to do this for. I personally have seen Jamie and the Redemption Coffee program help other women get into positions that they're looking for, whether it be in a barista or even if they need help going in a different direction, getting more training. Jamie is always available to help look up information. We applied for a program, the PACE NKG program, while I was still incarcerated, because it's a paid training on everything coffee, how to be a quality control Q grader. You know, so she's whatever is going to help us be as successful as possible.
That's wonderful. You know, part of this is the name, you know, Redemption Coffee. And a key word in that, obviously, is redemption. I mean, Legend, do you feel the meaning of that word while going through this program and reflecting on your time with this program?
Well, yeah, because through the program, you learn, especially with me, being as old as I was and getting in trouble, you know, making a mistake. I was like, oh, I'm a felon. This is what I kept saying. It was a way to motivate myself to do better as well, because I know I need to have different skills. But going through the program, what was given back to me was, you're not a felon. You have a felony background. you are not of this is I heard this every all the time. You are not a felon. You have a felony background, which made me think like, you know what? That's right. And so instead of looking at it in a negative connotation, I can now look at it in a positive connotation. And roundabout, Bewley's helps that too, because they're like, okay, yeah, we see that you have a background. We're going to give you a shot and see what you do with it from here.
That's so true. That's kind of, I mean, not just for our program, you're not a felon, you have a felony. Mm-hmm. What, I mean, that's the officers out there, the reentry team who are such an integral part to what I do out there. They're such a support and they don't get enough, I guess, recognition for what they do.
And but they keep up there. With you for a year after. You know, it's the reentry program is it's very good for people who want to make use of it and make the best out of it. It worked for me and I'm happy to be here. I told Jamie anything that she needs, I'll be right here.
You know, Jamie, what if students like Legend taught you?
Oh, that I don't know it all. That that I can regain another sense of purpose. These women have reignited not only my passion in coffee, but a passion I had no idea that was inside of me to kind of pay it forward or do something more with this industry that has cradled me for so long.
Yeah. I mean, you went from starting when it was just an idea to building the curriculum, actually putting it into practice and seeing results in people's lives like Legend. I mean, what is this journey meant to you? It's just really beginning.
Oh, it is just beginning because there's so much more to do. And I have to step back sometimes because I get so excited about things. And I have grown so much more as a trainer through these women and learning their stories and actually being able to talk about my stories too with them. I mean, it's, you know, it's a great feeling.
Legend, I mean, this came at a time when you were at our CCC. I mean, if Redemption Coffee didn't exist, how do you think your time and your life after once you were released, how it would have been different?
It definitely would have been a lot tougher. I don't fold very quickly, but I was out on the 17th, and that Monday I had my interview, and that following Monday I started working. I wouldn't have been able to find a job that paid me enough to make sure that I caught up on my bills and, you know, all of that in time enough to avoid, you know, detrimental situations. So the Redemption program definitely did help me out, and it helped keep my mind busy. It helped provide an oasis away from all of the hectic that's going on. You imagine living in a pod with 70 women, but they're behaving as if they're in middle school. You know, it becomes redundant. So to be able to actually leave and be gone from that for 8 hours a day or more, it gives you a kind of peace to be able to sit and focus on what you need to do next.
Legend and Jamie, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you for
You're
having
welcome.
Us.
Jamie Mason is the program director of Redemption Coffee, a specialty coffee training program offered to women incarcerated at Rio Cosumnes Correctional Center in Sacramento County. Legend Hightower is an alumna of the program and now works as a roaster at Bewley's North America. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Ben Jealous has worn many hats with a passion fueled by lived experience. He's arguably most well known as the youngest person to lead the national NAACP. But in addition to civil rights and social justice, his roles also span journalism, academia, politics, and the environment, all of which he would argue are all intertwined. Ben Jealous is now leading another legacy nonprofit rooted in activism, becoming the first African-American to lead the Sierra Club. Ben sat down with me on the heels of his new book, Never Forget Our People Were Always Free, A Parable of American Healing. Ben, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So looking into your career so far, I mean, it has such a wide-ranging amount of job titles, right? It spans civil rights to journalism, environmentalism, academia. You're the youngest person to lead the national NAACP. You're now the first person of color to lead the Sierra Club. I would imagine, although these job titles are different in terms of like a headline and they've changed over the course of your life, it's also tied to a core mission held deep within you.
It is. My grandmother's grandfather, who features at the center of my book, Never Forget Our People Were Always Free, really set the tone for professional achievement in our family. And he held a lot of titles. He was a preacher. He was a whiskey gauger. He was a lighthouse keeper. He was a statesman. He led a political party. He was a farmer. Everything he did was for the advancement of his community. He built schools. He founded a university. Was for the advancement of his community in the wake of slavery. And what you learn from somebody like that is that you should have a clear mission in your professional life. And beyond that, you should be like water. You should look for the fastest way to your destination. And as you pass through, make room for others to follow you.
How did those experiences not only shape your life, but your understanding of life, and ultimately lead to this new book, Never Forget Our People Were Always Free, A Parable of American Healing?
I was born on a bridge between black and white, north and south, and even the old America of the East Coast and the cutting edge of California. What that all taught me at the end of the day is that we always have more in common with our neighbors, not just our friends, the people who look like us or dress like us or actually live next door to us, but everybody else in this country, our fellow Americans, we always have more in common than we don't. And it's really only one conversation, maybe two, away from figuring that out. In my book, I tell the story of my old boss at the Jackson Advocate newspaper, the black newspaper for the state of Mississippi, and the then Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. My publisher was frustrated because the Ku Klux Klan kept burning down our newspaper. The straw that broke the camel's back is when they burned it down and riddled it with submachine gun bullets one night. So my publisher just reached out to him and said, let's have lunch. Years later, when I started working at the paper, they were still having lunch every month. And I said to him, like, why? You know, three or four conversations probably would have been enough to get him to stop burning down the paper. Why are you seeing him every month? And he said, well, we both figured out that we're like the only guys in town that are willing to debate the other one of us about how the Civil War could have ended, about alternative outcomes to the Civil War. So we get together every month to talk about the Civil War. And, you know, a lot of good came from that, including the fact that the Grand Wizard retired at a conversation with him. It kind of suggested that his friendship with my publisher sort of sapped him of his drive to keep leading the Ku Klux Klan. And when my publisher was dying, of all his white friends, the only one that showed up was the now former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. He cried at his bedside. He said, this man, as he was praying to God to protect my publisher's soul, the old Grand Wizard said, this man listened to me. This man understood me. This man was my friend. And then it occurred to me that not only had the Klan not attacked our paper ever again after those lunches started, but the next time it was attacked, the first call we got was from that old Grand Wizard to say he had checked in with all of his boys and none of them were involved. It actually turned out we're pretty sure to be a group of business leaders who simply thought that people would assume it was the Klan so they could get away with it.
I mean, you're talking about such a formative experience that perhaps a lot of people don't have in their life. I mean, when we're talking about we share more in similarities than we share in differences, why do you think it's hard for us to not only believe that at times, but actually lead with that?
You know, I would push back that people don't have it in their own daily experiences. I would say that most of us do at this point. There's so much disinformation on the internet.
Right.
Everybody seems to have a family member or a friend who gets pulled down some rabbit hole. And then you got to have a conversation with them about what the facts actually are. We have this current controversy now about Fox News national hosts knowing what the truth was and going out with something else. And so in this age of disinformation, it's actually urgent for all of us to discipline ourselves, to remember the human being on the other side of all those social media posts and connect with them. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, you know, when I'm on social media and I see what my friends are saying, my family's, I don't want anything to do with any of them. But then I get to the Super Bowl party or I get to Thanksgiving dinner and I'm like, you know, I actually like these people. Mm-hmm. And that's all that I'm really encouraging people to do, just with a broader circle than their family or friends.
Yeah.
My life has been transformed by something General Colin Powell urged me to do early in my career. He said, you know, Ben, it's easy to figure out what you disagree with somebody about. What's far more urgent in a democracy, and this is in the context of leading the NAACP. He said, what's far more urgent in a democracy is to figure out the one thing we can agree on and go get that done. That led me into very transformative friendships with a number of Republican governors who, as the then head of the NAACP, I knew I disagreed on like 100 things with, but in each case, we found one thing we agreed on and we got that done. Here in California, that was me and Arnold Schwarzenegger sitting down. He was governor. And I was, at that point, working on a campaign called Ban the Box. We were trying to help formerly incarcerated people get employment applications changed so there would no longer be a box in the front saying, have you been convicted? Simply wanted that in the interview. So if you decide you were interested in an applicant, then you could ask them and hear how that, you know, the context they provided, when maybe that conviction was, what it was for, and then decide if you wanted to hire them. But it was on the application. It just got thrown in the trash. And I sat down with Governor Schwarzenegger, and he looked at me and he said plainly, without irony, he said, you know, I used to be a bodybuilder. Half the guys in the gym were felons. All of them needed jobs. And then, you know, we went and we got that done.
The first part of your title is Never Forget Our People Were Always Free. What inspired this?
It was something my grandma used to say. I think a lot of people with ethnic grandmothers have at least one thing that grandma used to repeat that made no sense. This was that in my family. Three of her grandparents had been born into slavery, so how could she say this? She was chronologically dying. She was fit, but she was 103 when I really decided I had to finish the book. She would die just before I finished at 105. She was leaving us with a few mysteries, or threatening to leave us with a few mysteries. This was top of the list. She said it. Her mother said it. Her grandmother said it. Her great-grandma said it. That was especially remarkable because both of them had been born into slavery. My sister said it. My mom said it. I tried to stop my sister from saying it because I was like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, the woman's grandparents, what is she talking about? And so with the help of psychologists and genealogists and historians, geneticists even, we were able to figure out what was going on. She was repeating something that was repeated down her maternal line, that people repeated because they liked the way it made them feel without questioning the truth behind it. It was not dissimilar from my grandmother's not-so-distant cousin. They both descend from the same woman. My grandmother descends from Thomas Jefferson's grandmother. My grandmother's not-so-distant cousin, Thomas Jefferson, who would say in the context of a monarchy and feudalism, all men are endowed with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's no more ridiculous for a feudal subject to say than a black woman in America saying that her people were always free. But there was something else going on. So we dug. What we figured out is that the only time that that would have made sense would have been the first woman in my grandmother's maternal line to arrive in America as an enslaved woman. And that woman, we now know because of DNA and historical research, was a pirate woman from Madagascar. And what would a pirate woman say to her children and grandchildren born into slavery, but never forget our people were always free? And how would she say it? Perhaps as a call to insurrection, as a battle cry, or just simply to instill in each generation that freedom was our people's history, so therefore it must be our destiny.
Were there some parts of the book that were more challenging to write than others?
Yeah, I had to walk away from my keyboard for a week the moment I figured out that Confederate General Robert E. Lee was my cousin.
How did you process that over the week?
With whiskey.
That's understandable.
I'd like to think he might have done the same thing if he found out he was my cousin. But it reinforced for me, along with other things. You know, another tough part was reading the will of a man who knew he was his cousin, the last man to own my grandmother's paternal grandfather and paternal great-grandfather, Richard Yates Bland, man who owned many enslaved people, but only mentioned one in his will, my grandmother's great-grandfather. Richard didn't have the courage to free him, to free Frederick Bland, but he spent every sentence of a paragraph in his will protecting him. And I sat down with the historian Henry Louis Gates Jr., and I said, what is going on here? And he said, well, based on the DNA, based on everything we know, these documents, others, Richard Bland understands that his enslaved manservant, Frederick Bland, is his older brother by 6 years. And while he doesn't have the courage to free him, he's trying to protect him every way he can. And without taking anything away from all the other truths about our country, it underscored that in addition to all of that, our country is dysfunctional. People's, you know, it can be very abusive. It's also a family. We're just simply a dysfunctional, abusive family in addition to, you know, the nation created out of, you know, 13 colonies and the corporations that they were. And it just underscored for me that the sooner that we actually act like any other American might be our cousin, the better off we'll be. I mean, look what happened to Bernie Sanders and Larry David. Larry David was on Saturday Night Live imitating Bernie Sanders. People were like, wow, that's a little bit too dead on. They got them to take their DNA. It turns out that they're third cousins from Brooklyn. They had no idea.
How did writing this book touch and shape you? I mean, I can just tell from, you know, that one anecdote you shared tremendously. Mm. You learned a great deal about yourself, but also in the pursuit of inspiring collective healing for our country.
You know, they say that if you put a bunch of mice in a box and you electrify a cube for, say, a month, it'll be four generations before a mouse from that family will climb on that metal cube again. My brother-in-law, his family lost 200 family members in Auschwitz. For him, that cube is Germany. For me, our family was enslaved in Virginia for more than 250 years. For us, that cube was Virginia. And then you add to that the decades after that of Jim Crowism and all of that, 300 years of suffering in Virginia. I've spent a lot of my life not far from Virginia on the Chesapeake Bay. My school years were here in Northern California, summers with my grandparents in Baltimore, ran for governor of Maryland, lived in D.C. I would never cross that line. People would push me and say, ah, my family ran away from Virginia twice. Why would I ever go back? But it's left me curious about Virginia. Apparently the same thing happened to Frederick Douglass. You know, he had run away from slavery in Maryland, went on to be ambassador to Haiti, have all these posts. But eventually, he discovered he had a great passion for the state he was born into, despite the circumstances of his birth. So it definitely has made me more curious about Virginia and kind of put me at peace, if you will.
You're listening to Insight here at Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ben Jealous about his new book, Never Forget Our People Were Always Free, A Parable of American Healing. I want to learn more about your role with the Sierra Club. Where did your love for the environment and your drive to protect it come from?
Big Sur in Yosemite, Sequoia National Park. As a kid out here, you know, I always thought it was my white dad who had grown up in the woods of Maine, you know, an umpteenth generation New England outdoorsman. I thought it was my dad. Turns out it was my mom who grew up in the public housing projects in West Baltimore. She pointed out your father had had enough of the woods by the time he was able to drink legally, you know. My mom, on the other hand, had been deprived her entire childhood. And so they made sure every chance they could that we got out into the redwoods of Big Sur, of Santa Cruz Mountains, of the Sequoias, of Yosemite. It was the playground of my youth. And then in my teens, A company named Max Zam started clear-cutting old-growth redwoods. And a group of young idealists called Earth First started climbing up in trees to stop them. And it captured my imagination. For a young teenage me, that was exactly what you should do, is stop them however you could, you know, do what the Ewoks would do, if you will. And I was all for it. The first time I ever organized a protest, as opposed to attending one with my parents, it was helping to organize young people from Monterey County to come up here to Sacramento for an anti-clear-cutting protest against Max Zam. I was 14 or 15 years old, and that was the beginning of a life as an environmental activist.
Yeah, I read a headline that you were the first person of color, you are, to lead the Sierra Club. Is that just a headline to you, or is there more meaning behind this milestone?
You know, I would say we did have an acting executive director who's Asian American and a good man named Dan Chu. He's the head of the foundation. We have had Black and Latino and Asian American and female board chairs. However, not one of the, or and also, if you will, not one of the largest environmentalist groups in the country have ever had a Black person lead them, or a Native American person, or a Latino. And for those groups that were in large numbers on the wrong side of colonialism, if you will, maybe on the right side, but on the side, on the receiving end of a lot of abuse, treated without exception as disposable by an old way of accumulating wealth in this country, it's important to have leadership in environmentalist organizations that sees those communities, that knows the leadership of those communities, and knows how to pull folks in as equals and get big things done, in part because the Latino community has always been the community most ready to support new regulations to protect our environment. Blacks have always been the second most likely. Native Americans are also very high. But in most states, as far as the polling, what you see is Latinos and Blacks are the two top groups. A movement can only be so successful taking its own base for granted. And Black and brown communities, well, as Van Jones often says, there is no green vote without the Black or brown vote.
What do you hope readers gain from your book? What do you want to leave them with?
What I hope to leave folks with is the urgent need for each of us to practice the golden rule with courage and with faith, that our actions in our own life can have a huge impact on our nation as a whole. That's what Dr. King was trying to teach us at the end of his life. He was trying to show us through the Poor People's Campaign. You know, he was not assassinated leading a desegregation effort. He was assassinated leading a Poor People's Campaign, trying to pull people together. And he was trying to teach us that racism, in addition to being like the boot on Black folks or Native Americans or Latino folks' backs, or you know, Asian Americans' backs, is also a wedge that was designed by a colonial government that understood that their preservation of the king's ability to extract great wealth from the American colonies depended on dividing the two largest groups in the colony. And in the colony, which was defined by, you know, the people who came there to extract wealth or were enslaved and brought there to extract wealth, the two largest groups were indentured Europeans and enslaved Africans. And they changed the definition of the word race from an old word, a tribe, to a new pseudoscientific theory that said that there were multiple human races. And they did that about 100 years after 1619. And it was clearly embraced by the colonial powers as a way to divide groups so they would stop rebelling together. Dr. King was trying to teach at the end of his life, we have more in common than we don't. We can, you can't be all you can be till I can be all I can be. And the sooner that we realize that, the more power that we'll have to make our country leap forward.
Ben, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
That is Ben Jealous discussing his new book, Never Forget Our People Were Always Free, a parable of American healing. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're closing a special hour, taking a listen back to some of the most memorable conversations this year. We end with the city of Sacramento honoring Tyree Nichols. The 29-year-old died following a brutal beating by Memphis police. But before Tennessee, Tyree, an avid skateboarder, called Sacramento home. In the weeks following his death, Insight producer Victor Corral Martinez met with two of Tyree's closest friends, Ryan Wilson and Jerome Neal, and put together a piece in their own words.
My name is Ryan Wilson. He was my best friend in the whole world, like my brother. You know, he was everything to me. I met him out over at the Regency Skate Park about late 2007, probably 2008-ish. And, you know, for a while, he was kind of like keeping to himself, had his headphones in, and he sort of didn't talk a whole lot, but then eventually, you know, I broke through and we just couldn't stop talking, and we became real close after that. Tyree was one of those people where, like, me and him, one of the things we shared in common was, like, he had, like, abilities, but he kind of would, like, he would doubt himself a lot of times and just sort of, like, he would overthink things, but then when he'd have those spark of, like, just inspiration, he'd watch a really good video or he'd want to show off for someone, you know, if there was like a pro at the park or something. You know, he had it in him to do really cool things when he put his mind to it. Well, it's kind of a roller coaster. I mean, like, you know, we've all lost family members and this and that, you know, throughout the years. But, you know, just like someone that close, like, you know, a lot of times when they're that young, it sort of feels like they're untouchable. You know, tragedies happen, but you never think that you're going to be that person. And like, you can't really predict or like control like how your mind and body sort of like handles it. So like it's been coming in waves and everything where I'll just some random song or some random thing will sort of bring it back. A lot of songs by like The Killers he really liked. So he was always looking at new stuff and trying to find new stuff that you know, stuff that gets you excited, you know, gives you energy. And yeah, whenever I hear dubstep, even though like I'm not particularly a fan of it, like, you know, we did a lot of songs or a lot of videos with that whole thing. And yeah, just like anything like that sort of would really get me going. I mean, the thing is Tyree was like, you know, he was always a little bit older than a lot of us. I mean, I'm only 2 years like younger than him, but a lot of us, like he got used to taking people under his wing, and it doesn't help that he was 18 feet tall either. So, you know, that's kind of what skateboarding is. You know, you help people out, and like Tyree knew what it was like to be, you know, in the little kid's shoes. You know, you're doing something you're not familiar with, you're scared, you're maybe nervous. And he really was like, he loved helping kids. It's something he always wanted to be a part of for the rest of his life. He's like, I don't care how much money I'm making. I don't care where I'm going. Like, as long as I'm filming and taking pictures and this and that, that's good enough for me. And as you saw, like in his later years, he loved sunsets and things like that. So yeah, he was just happy to be behind the camera. I've talked with a lot of different people, a lot of his other friends, his family. I feel like we're doing actually a great job of, you know, really sharing what kind of person he was. I mean, there's only so much you can really say about a person, but just his kind-hearted, you know, spirit and his, like, willingness to make everyone smile at all times, even when he maybe wasn't able to smile himself. I mean, this stuff's been said over and over again, and, like, I think it's doing a great job. He was on this earth for almost 3 decades, and that particular incident was very short-lived, you know, maybe a couple days from the time it happened to the time he moved on. And it's like, that's not fair to, you know, reflect and think about his whole life based on that one particular incident. That does not reflect him as a person and who he was to me and his family and everyone else. And the fact that that one particular thing can bring out the whole nation, like, that's, like, it's wild. It just really shows how close we are, you know, as a community. And it doesn't matter if you know someone or not, you know, that's, we're all kind of part of the same family in one way or another.
Jerome Neal. I've known Tyree for 13 years. I've been like one of his skate friends ever since. You know, met him at a skate park and was just friends ever since then, just like naturally. Him and I have always been into cameras, and him and I made like videos together and stuff. So like we really had a pretty big connection. Like him and I used to go back and forth just creatively like all the time. Like we were like just so connected. Each of us that skated with Tyree has all learned something from him. Like the past couple of days when I go out and skate, I literally do tricks that Tyree taught me, because he's taught me like quite a bit, like especially like on like the half pipe or like mini ramp. Like he was so good at that. Like you can watch him one day and you just be in shock at the way he can just, you know, gracefully skate that thing. And like I said, he was giving it to all of us. Like we all have a little bit of Tyree in us, because he was, like you said, a mentor. He was just sharing information that he had, helping others in situations he knew he could help us with. Like he was just like a golden soul, bro. Like that's the best way to put it. Just was always there, would motivate you, talk you through with things, convince you you could do something when you didn't believe in your own self. Like that was Tyree. When I first heard about it and he was like, you know, in the hospital, he hadn't gone, passed away yet, I didn't think he would go. I had full faith that Tyree was going to pull through. I was going to see him again. You know, he was going to go through a rough time, but he was going to be okay. And then a couple days later, that was just wrong. And that just wasn't his path. And it was just been really sad. It still hasn't not been sad. Like every morning, every day, I'm just like stuck constantly thinking about him and just like how crazy this situation is and how none of it should have ever happened. Tyree's like one of the nicest dudes I know. Like something just as bad as this shouldn't happen to such a good person. Just doesn't make sense. It was like I was watching a nightmare. Like it didn't feel like a real situation. It still doesn't feel real to me. Like seeing something like that to someone that I cared so much about and that was just such a kind, genuine person to experience something that intense. Like, yeah, I can't put it into words. Is there room for one more son? One more son. If you can't hold on, if you can't hold on, hold on. Yeah, the visuals are beautiful to see. People just, you know, showing respect to Tyree. And I know he's just, like, super stoked on, you know, people caring, people, you know, sharing his name, people sharing his video. Like, you know, Tony Hawk saw his video and posted on his Instagram. Like, Tyree is screaming right now, like, with joy. The Regency Skate Park, where they did the candle lighting, the candles are still there. We've been adding more every day. Like, it's a beautiful place, and it really feels like Tyree's still there. Like, him skating there so much, you can just sit there and visualize stuff he's done back in the day. His spirit just is just sitting there. I wanna shine on in the hearts of men. I want a meaning from the back of my broken hand. Another headaches, another heartbreaks. I'm so much older than I can take. And my affection, well, it comes and goes. I need direction to perfection. No, no, no. Help me out. Yeah, you know you gotta help me out. Yeah.
That is Jerome Neal and Ryan Wilson. The two were close friends with Tyree Nichols, who was killed by Memphis police in January. Tyree also called Sacramento home and was an avid skateboarder at Regency Community Skate Park. The city voted to rename it the Tyree Nichols Skate Park. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.